This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, May 14, 2004. At WBAI in New York, I'm Deepa Fernandez. US soldiers have attacked al-Sadr's militia in Najaf, closing in on two sides on the Imam Ali shrine that Sadr has made his headquarters, while fleeing Indians speak out about US army abuses. As celebrations continue in India after the defeat of the far-right BJP party, we go to Indian-administered Kashmir to see what election results mean for Kashmiris. And the US Geological Survey releases a series of 15 reports today concerning the health of major river basins across the country. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Today, a reported 1 million Cubans marched in rallies organized by the Castro government, proclaiming their objections to new policies passed down by the Bush administration against the island nation. Joseph Muti reports from the demonstrations in Cuba.
Well in excess of a million Cubans were packed along the Malecon seafront this morning in a march that began with a short, angry address by Fidel Castro, who accused Bush of a policy of overt fascism across the planet. The recent measures taken by Washington have affected everyone here because the Cuban government has taken steps to protect the economy by restricting the dollar's spending power on the island. So today's protest was very spirited and very, very big. There really is a sense of outrage in the streets here. Some of this morning's protesters were carrying banners with the images of Iraqi prisoners in U.S. jails that have become so famous across the world. In reference to the use of economic restrictions to squeeze the Cuban economy even further, another banner with the dollar sign next to a crossed-out swastika read, "The New Symbol of Fascism." In Havana, for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Joseph Muti.
Cuba's United Nations representative said Cuba will defend its socialist state no matter what the United States government threatens. Heather Visby reports from the UN.
Addressing a news conference this week, the Cuban ambassador to the United Nations, Orlando Risque, accused the U.S. government of pursuing an aggressive policy that aims at recolonizing the island nation. The ambassador said the U.S. embargo has cost Cuba more than $72 billion, which he described as a flagrant violation of the human rights of 11 million Cuban people. He claimed that as part of its campaign against Cuba, the Bush administration is planning to spend about $59 billion on propaganda through media outlets such as Radio Marti and television. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Heather Rizvi at the United Nations.
Native Americans are critical of voting changes being implemented in some states under the Bush administration's Help America Vote Act, or HAVA. Jim Kent has the story.
Three Affiliated Tribes chairman Tex Hall says North Dakota's voter registration requirement of a photo ID listing a resident's address may make it impossible for many Native Americans to vote.
The requirement was driver's licenses in order to vote, and we testified and said, wow, for goodness sakes, a lot of our people, especially the elderly, you know, they don't have driver's licenses. We had to have a coordinator come, and she said that, you have to have a street address, too, on that tribal ID. And I said, for goodness sakes, I have a P.O. box number like many of us that live out in our rural reservations. We don't have a street address.
Lakota attorney Tom Van Norman sees South Dakota's photo ID registration requirement as an attempt by the state's Republican majority to intimidate Native Americans at the polls. South Dakota Democrat Tim Johnson won re-election to the U.S. Senate in 2002 by the overwhelming vote of Native Americans. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Jim Kent.
The nation's so-called missile defense system will be installed in September, despite a report by scientists demonstrating that the multi-billion-dollar system is unreliable and ineffective. Ingrid Drake has this report from D.C.
The Union of Concerned Scientists released a report showing the Pentagon's missile defense shield will be incapable of defending the United States from incoming warheads when it is activated this September. The ballistic missile shield, built by Boeing, incorporates ground, air, and sea operations and costs an estimated $55 billion. Lisbeth Grönlund, co-author of the 76-page study Technical Realities, says President Bush should halt deployment and immediately conduct realistic testing of the missile system. Last month, Congress's General Accounting Office criticized the Pentagon's Missile Defense Agency for providing Congress with incomplete information about costs and performance of the system. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Ingrid Drake.
A federal judge is refusing to stop same-gendered marriages scheduled to begin on Monday in Massachusetts. Chuck Rosina has more from Boston.
The Circuit Court of Appeals has agreed to review the case promptly. Conservative groups are saying they will pursue their case up to the U.S. Supreme Court if necessary. Meanwhile, Massachusetts prepares to begin marrying same-sex couples Monday. As many opponents of gay marriage see it, same-sex unions will make homosexuality more acceptable and fracture their views of family values. Gay couples and their supporters are poised for a major celebration rally, which will take place on the steps of the Massachusetts State House late Monday afternoon. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Chuck Rosina in Boston.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
There have been large demonstrations today against Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr by Iraqis demanding that he quit the city of Najaf. Meanwhile, in Najaf, U.S. soldiers have attacked al-Sadr's militia, closing in from two sides on the Imam Ali shrine that Sadr has made his headquarters. FSRN's Dave Enders has this report from Iraq.
Despite 3 hours of sustained fighting in Najaf today, Sadr still gave his weekly sermon in Kufa, a few miles to the east. According to James Longley, an American filmmaker, the U.S. attack began around 10:30 this morning as tanks closed in on the shrine from the south and the north, and U.S. troops battled militiamen in Wadi as-Salam, a holy cemetery more than 1,000 years old. The Jaish al-Mahdi, Sadr's militia, are taking it really seriously, and I think they've moved out all of their important people from the shrine, Longley says. They moved out all the people during morning prayer. Najafi's loyal to other clerics have become notably more agitated with Sadr in past days, and a large demonstration had been planned for today outside the shrine, but was cancelled because of the fighting. In Sadr City, the Baghdad slum named for Sadr's martyred father, militiamen milled the streets and prepared for confrontation with U.S. troops. Others have responded to Sadr's call for more militiamen to come to Najaf. Raad Khademi is head of the Sadr office in Khadmiya, another heavily Shiite neighborhood in Baghdad.
It will be jihad. Until now, we have just been fighting to protect ourselves. Sayed Muqtada offered to negotiate with the Americans, but they decided to attack instead.
Al-Sadr has refused to negotiate with anyone but the occupation authorities, and though his deputies met with Najafi leaders and representatives of other Shiite parties earlier this week, today's fighting has effectively stalled negotiations. Khademi again.
They all belong to the Americans and the leader of the terrorists, George Bush.
Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, who appeals to the greatest majority of Shiites in Iraq, has continued to remain quiet, despite conflicting reports that either the U.S. Army or Sadr's militia has damaged the holy shrine. Ali al-Wadi, a representative for Sistani in Khadmiya, says the Ayatollah is standing by his fatwa from January, condemning all violence, and that Sadr should leave the shrine and agree to negotiations. I'm David Enders, reporting from Baghdad for Free Speech Radio News.
Meanwhile, as the scandal continues over the U.S. and British abuses of Iraqi detainees, one side of the story that's virtually unreported is the treatment of other foreigners, particularly South Asians. Testimonials of poor and illiterate Indian workers who've escaped from U.S. Army camps in Iraq reveal they ended up trapped for months working as virtual slaves. Four kitchen assistants are now speaking out after they escaped from Iraq and have arrived back in their homes in the southern Indian state of Kerala. From India, our correspondent Vinod K. Jose reports.
The creator of atom bombs, the creators of chemical weapons, the creators of all war machinery.
The anti-American, anti-war protesters in India have one more reason to shout slogans. Hundreds of poor Indians are recruited for the U.S. Army camps for manual labor. Now the allegations of abuse by U.S. troops told by the first batch of returnees sparked outrage in India last week, drawing comparisons with the treatment of Iraqi prisoners. Not just ex-servicemen, even skilled and semi-skilled labor is being recruited from India to serve the coalition forces in Iraq. The workers from poorer Indian states are fooled into believing they will be going to Kuwait it is only later they realize that they will be forcibly taken to Iraq. Four kitchen assistants have escaped from a U.S. military base in Iraq and returned home last week. Fasil Aliur Kunya is one of the four escaped and reached home.
"10 months back, we were recruited by an agent offering jobs in Kuwait. Once we reached Kuwait City, we were received by representatives of the company and hustled into a bus headed to Iraq. When we protested, we were threatened. I had to work in a camp of American soldiers. I was a butcher, working in their kitchen. I was paid peanuts, plus the humiliation. We were treated like virtual slaves. I never thought I would ever see my wife and three children. I shudder to think of innocent Indians taken to Iraq like lambs to the slaughter. It was a real nightmare for me."
Free Speech Radio News had reported about a covert gang recruiting hundreds of Indian workers to the U.S. bases in Kuwait in July of last year. When these workers returned home, it was made clear that they were duped and taken to Iraq by a contractor on behalf of a unit of the U.S. firm Halliburton. Halliburton, formerly run by Vice President Dick Cheney, is the U.S. military's top contractor in Iraq, providing services ranging from laundry to oil field repair. It is poverty and unemployment that force Indians, mostly from its southern states, to migrate to the Gulf countries. I asked Anil Kumar, an office boy in a private firm in Delhi, if he would ever go to Iraq if he was offered $200 a month.
"Yes, definitely. Why not? Here I get just $75 a month. As of now, I hardly get any money to send home. If someone is able to pay me more than $75, I don't have any problem to do any work anywhere in the world."
An estimated 3 million Indians work in the Gulf, many as laborers, construction workers, or in hotels and restaurants. It is estimated that more than 1,300 Indians are in Iraq. At the request of the Indian government, U.S. officials have launched an investigation into the complaints. Fasil Aliur Kunzu ran away from the camp for Jordan by bus. With the help of the Indian embassy, he was taken to Amman and then flown to Mumbai. He believes that South Indians continue to be smuggled into Iraq.
"In my humble opinion, no one should get fooled by companies like these. The time has changed. Now the Americans are looking desperately for workers to do slave jobs for them. I have told all my friends and in my village not to get cheated by the contractors."
From India, I am Vinod K. Jose for Free Speech Radio News.
Also in India, as we reported yesterday, celebrations continue after the defeat of the ruling BJP Hindu Right Party. Today, the Congress Party, headed by Sonia Gandhi, began the task of forming a coalition government with the support of smaller parties, many of them left-wing parties, as no single party had achieved a clear majority. As part of the parliamentary elections, polls were also held in the troubled state of Jammu and Kashmir, the Indian-administered region of Kashmir. Violence dominated the election process in Kashmir, with separatist groups who have long demanded an independent country calling for a boycott of the polls. And while India claims the participation of the Kashmiri people in the elections shows their faith in Indian democracy, the violence and widespread allegations of coercion and bogus voting is a sharp indication to the contrary. FSRN's Shahnawaz Khan files this report from Srinagar.
This week marked the final phase of elections in India. While the elections are a routine democratic process in India, when it comes to elections in Indian-administered Kashmir, it assumes a different significance. Bashir Manzar is the editor of Srinagar-based daily Kashmir Image.
"As far as Indian view goes, they want to convey to the world that if Kashmiris participate in elections, they are giving a mandate to India to rule Kashmir. And on the other hand, the separatists who want India out of Kashmir, they feel that if Kashmiris boycott elections, they convey to the world that they no longer want to be with India."
The All Parties Hurriyat Conference called for a strike on polling days as a show of solidarity to Kashmiris' right to self-determination. Kashmiri separatists also urged Kashmiris to boycott the polls during all the four phases. Yasin Malik is the chairman of Jammu and Kashmir Liberation Front, one of the political groups that called for the boycott.
"People of Kashmir throw their weight through a democratic process for boycott, and they have conveyed a democratic message to the international community that they must resolve the Kashmir dispute in accordance with the wishes of the people of Jammu.
Zahiruddin is a member of Jammu and Kashmir Coalition of Civil Society, a local group that monitored the elections.
Well, the people by and large boycotted the polls. The teams deputed by Jammu and Kashmir Coalition of Civil Society saw soldiers driving people out of their homes, herding them to the polling booths, and at some places, the voters were told to cast their vote in favor of a particular party.
But more than the political or democratic fight, it is the violence which dominated the elections in Kashmir. Armed groups opposing the polls used violence to disrupt the elections. A report by a team of Indian human rights activists from Civil Liberties Bangalore acknowledges the allegations of coercive vote. Most of the political rallies were attacked and blasters rocked on the polling days.
We do not want to vote, but the army is forcing us to vote. Our problems are never addressed. Why should we vote? The militants ask us not to vote. The security forces are pulling us out to vote.
While the separatists claim their victory in the boycott campaign, the government claims the polls were successful and generated a good turnout. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Shahnawaz Khan from Srinagar, Kashmir.
The U.S. Geological Survey released a series of 15 reports today concerning the health of major river basins across the country. WPFW's Selena Masuda reports.
These reports begin to help provide the information where you can sort out where do we see compounds occurring, where do we not see them occurring, and then it begins to answer the question, why?
That was Tim Miller, Chief of the Office of Water Quality at the U.S. Geological Survey, USGS. Miller was one of several speakers that presented reports from the National Water Quality Assessment Program, NACA. The reports generally support the idea that the rivers and streams in the U.S. are generally suitable for irrigation, supplying drinking water, and other uses, even though the report cites that these resources are being degraded by man-made and natural contaminants. However, Miller admits that there is much more research to do since the current regulatory standards do not often reflect the reality of nature.
We have not looked at whether or not mixtures of compounds or the breakdown products from pesticides have significant human influences. But we say that the water quality is generally good in relationship to the currently existing standards for drinking water and aquatic health. But again, the comparisons that we're making are to criteria and standards or guidelines that only look at single compounds, not what we actually find in the environment, the mixtures and the breakdown products. Research has not been done along those lines yet.
One of the research sites was in Louisiana. Gary Rowe, assistant regional hydrologist for NACA at USGS, studied a case in Louisiana in which rice farmers combated their weevil problem by using a pesticide called Icon with the active ingredient fipronil.
So the rice farmers down there were applying that to their rice paddies. The problem with that was when they are finished growing the rice, they switch over and grow crawfish or raise crawfish in there for commercial harvest. And a crawfish is basically, it's a benthic invertebrate. But anyway, it's similarly affected by that insecticide compound. It's not good for them. And so there was an issue down there when they started using that. They saw dramatic declines in their crawfish harvest.
The farmers filed a lawsuit against the manufacturers and sellers of the pesticide Icon for not adequately testing and considering how Icon would react with the rice crawfish rotation system used in Louisiana. Much of the NACA research has focused on land areas that are being developed. Robert Miltner of the Ohio Environmental Protection Agency.
It's correct to point out that we really haven't considered the ecological consequences of land development in any kind of planning sense. It's just something that wasn't really on anybody's radar screen. And now we're going around and looking at the streams around the nation in metropolitan areas, and almost everywhere you look, when somebody does a study on it, they find that, yes, indeed, as you increase the amount of urban land within a given drainage area, you find decreasing health of the community or the water quality of that area. So now with that information in hand, we can start saying, well, why is that?
The Bush administration will request the present level of funding for the 2005 fiscal year, $62 million, for this research. Because of inflation, the USGS must continue to cut research costs and will only be able to study 42 of the 51 areas in the second phase of the program. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Selena Masuta of the DC Radio Co-op.
Regulations establishing nurse-to-patient ratios in California hospitals went into effect on New Year's Day. But 2 days before the effective date, the California Healthcare Association, the trade organization for California's hospital industry, filed suit against the California Department of Health Services, the DHS, claiming the department's insistence that hospitals be in compliance with the ratios at all times means that virtually all hospitals will be unable to comply with regulations because they will not be able to provide fill-in coverage for breaks and lunch periods. A hearing on that lawsuit was scheduled for today in Sacramento. More from Kelly Ramirez at Pacifica Station, KPFA in Berkeley.
California's new staffing ratios range from 1 to 1 in triage and trauma units to 1 to 8 in well baby nurseries. According to a frequently asked questions list issued by the DHS, the state has had staffing ratios in intensive care and critical care units for 28 years. Some hospitals, such as the Kaiser Permanente chain and the University of California Medical Centers, were already in compliance when the ratios took effect. But other hospitals, including several in the Sutter chain, have had compliance issues.
This is about
patient care.
Said this is about
patient care.
The California Nurses Association, the CNA, has held several demonstrations at Sutter facilities in the San Francisco Bay Area to support the ratios. In Oakland, a registered nurse in oncology described how hard it would be not to have enough staff in the cancer unit.
I deal with patients who are dealing with an incredible crisis. That means that there are patients there who are in severe pain, who are air hungry, post-operative patients who may be bleeding. We may have a patient who's confused, who's trying to climb out of bed, who's at risk for a fall. If we don't have enough registered nurses on the floor, if we don't have enough CNAs and LVNs available to us, then we end up making decisions about which room we go to. Which one am I not gonna go to? Do I ignore the pain, the air hunger? Do I ignore the bleeding?
California ranks 49th among the states in nurses per capita. Leslie Kelsey, Assistant Administrator for Public Affairs at San Jose Medical Center, told the Pennsylvania-based newsletter Medical News Report that the starting salary for new nurses with a 2-year degree and no hospital experience was $70,000 with 100% employer-paid health and retirement benefits. Yet there were openings at her hospital. The hospital industry claims it is unable to comply with the staffing ratios because of a nursing shortage. But Liz Jacobs, RN, spokesperson for the California Nurses Association, disagrees.
There is not a shortage of nurses in California. There's a shortage of nurses willing to work in unsafe staffing conditions. California graduates about 6,600 nurses every year. There's going to be a need for 5,000 additional nurses. There has been a third of all nurses working part-time. Then because of safe staffing conditions, they're bumping up their hours.
The CNA's website, calnurse.org, accuses the hospital industry of trying, quote, to fan hysteria in hopes of softening public support for the ratios, unquote. When Santa Teresita Hospital in Southern California announced that it would close as of January 9th, the California Healthcare Association issued a press release calling the closure, quote, the tragic consequence of unrealistic nurse ratio regulations, unquote. But a KNBC Los Angeles report on the closure stated that the hospital was without financial reserves or the ability to borrow money, which suggests that the Carmelite-run hospital faced closure even without the ratios. The hospital industry's approach to the media has also been antagonistic at times. Jan Emerson is Vice President of External Affairs for the California Healthcare Association.
This is not a simple story. This is a very complex story.
I agree, and in 4 minutes it's not going to be told. I think you said something very valuable to me about a nurse being in the break room. You have to comply and have another nurse standing by.
Are you an NPR station?
No, I'm not.
Okay. You're the station that's the extreme left liberal station in Berkeley, correct?
The CNA staged a rally in March today from the State Capitol building in Sacramento to the Superior Courtroom for the hearing on the lawsuit against DHS. For FSRN, I'm Kelia Ramirez.
Pennsylvania death row prisoner, journalist and FSRN commentator Mumia Abu-Jamal reflects on the May 17 historic anniversary of the Supreme Court decision of Brown versus the Board of Education.
It has been half a century since Brown versus Board of Education became law, and the racial segregation of public schools was outlawed, and desegregation was ordered with all deliberate speed. When Brown was first decided, I was not yet born. Yet, despite the law which ruled segregation unconstitutional, my elementary, junior high, and high schools were institutions with over 95%, perhaps 98% black populations. Whites, whether as teachers or students, were quite rare over a decade after Brown became law. Years later, in my private studies, I learned that Brown wasn't decided because of the educational needs or violated rights of black citizens, but because of the ideological needs of the U.S. government, which was trying to present a false face to much of the Third World, many of whom were horrified at the images of dark-skinned people brutalized by racist cops for trying to get a decent education. In 1952, U.S. Secretary of State Dean Acheson submitted a letter to the U.S. Supreme Court noting that, quote, the continuation of racial discrimination is a source of constant embarrassment to this government, and it jeopardizes the effective maintenance of our moral leadership of the free and democratic nations of the world, unquote. Brown, then, was a propaganda victory designed to defeat rhetorical attacks from the communist countries, which argued that the U.S. was a violent and racist nation. It's been 50 years since Brown, and ghetto schools from coast to coast, from north to south, are as segregated as they were in 1953. They're segregated not by law, but by practice, as a class, poverty-stricken, with few resources, increasingly poorly trained, poorly paid, and demoralized teachers, and few educational expectations or outcomes of excellence. Brown may be law on the books, but in the lives of millions of dark-skinned kids, it's barely an asterisk. It is meaningless. The brilliant legal scholar Derrick Bell has long argued that Brown represents a prime example of what he calls interest convergence, or an occasion when blacks may benefit, but in order to do so, whites must benefit. Thus, under Brown, almost half of black educators, especially in the South, lost their jobs. Whites were hired to replace them, and also for the swell of private white academies that sprung up in opposition to the Brown decision. Today, schools are but training grounds for prisons, and in an age of computerization and increasing outsourcing, they're struggling to find economic and social relevance. Let the bourgeoisie and the black middle class celebrate Brown. Meanwhile, let the rest of us ignore it. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are produced by Noel Hanrahan for Prison Radio.
Free Speech Radio News is produced at Pacifica Stations WBAI in New York, KPFA in Berkeley, and KPFK in Los Angeles, and community radio station WMNF in Tampa, Florida. Producers are Kata Mesta, Simba Russo, and Monica Lopez. Our headlines editors are Nell Abram and Randy Zimmerman. Our DC editor is Mitch Jeserich. Technical producers are Jade Paget-Seekins, Lindsay Benedict, Pauline Bartolone, and Mick Million. We have web support from Vanessa Tate and Leslie Holmes. FSRN is a worker-run collective. For more information, you can visit our website at www.fsrn.org. In New York, I'm Deepa Fernandez.